So I am so delighted to sit in this room with you. It was just such a pleasure to look around beforehand and see you all. It is a very special group of people to be together with. I won't go through the list for you of all the groups of people who would be a lot less comfortable for me to be with. I don't think their retreat is long enough. But this is a pretty special gathering of people. I feel, the level of ethical integrity of this group is relatively high, and the dedication to being truthful is relatively high. That's what's required in doing mindfulness practice. The dedication to kind of work through some of our afflictions and our biases and our ways in which we might harm each other and try to get the other way and not do that anymore is pretty high among this group. And it's pretty nice, thank you. It's very nice for me personally. It supports me in my practice and inspires me, and it's a wonderful thing to have this. So I want to just thank you all for this and being here. So that's how I felt sitting down. And I think it's a coincidence, but anyway, one of the purposes I'd like to have this talk be, if it's possible, is to support you in feeling better about yourself. Somehow support you in such a way that you feel like you're a friend of yourself, your own friend, and that you have some sense, or have maybe intuitive sense of a possibility, or you know that really coming home to yourself, settling into yourself, into your heart, or into who you are in some deeper way, is a very welcoming and wonderful thing, and it's a good place, and it's good to be connected with yourself. So we'll see how I manage. I don't have any particular strategy for doing that, but just, you know, a wish. This theme for the retreat, we call it the seven stages of purification. And Brian yesterday talked about the relay chariot simile. And so the king gets on his chariot, and you know, he doesn't get, it's not a non-stop flight for the king. There has, you know, seven stops along the way. And so that's kind of nice that we have all these stops along the way, that we have to really face something and see something and discover something and grow up to something, become free of something. And so they're called purifications, seven purifications. And I think of purifications that involves shedding something, of letting something go. It's not so much about attainments and getting something, but rather shedding things and letting things go, and kind of a deeper or fuller way of letting go of that which is extra, that which is not needed, that which maybe is afflictive or causes us suffering or brings delusion or something. And it might not seem so welcoming to some people that just to shed the things which, you know, that's purification process. If the idea of being happy and healthy is having and getting and things. But I think also of this, when I think of this king going from one palace to another, I mostly think of him, he's going home. And so we're going home in this path or in this unfolding. We're coming home here to ourselves in some deep way. and to find this home here. I think that makes it much more, we're shedding all the things that keeps us from being home. Maybe that makes it a little more inviting, the idea of shedding or purifying, emptying. I think that the deepest home is connected to liberation, to freedom. The Buddha said that the essence of all things, the core of all things, the heartwood of all things, is liberation, is freedom. And if it's the heartwood, the essence, the core of all things, I guess that means it's you're a thing too, kind of. So it's your essence, your core. And to be able to breathe easily, that kind of have the easy breath of freedom, to have the ease of being in one's body that comes with freedom, the ease of being able to walk through the world in this body with breathing at ease, is a phenomenal thing. And it's not easy in this world to find that and get to it. There's a lot of forces, a lot of difficulties that people have that contribute to not feeling free, and some of them are external, the world around us, people around us, tremendous forces of oppression and challenges that people have. And we have the opportunity here, phenomenal opportunity, to discover something internal about freedom, and a kind of freedom that is portable, hopefully, and that will stay with us as we go through the world and find our way through it. In teaching all this, the Buddha, I think of the Buddha as being sometimes a little mischievous, or something like that, a little bit of a trickster at times, because he loved to, seemingly loved, I don't know, he had the habit of using words in unusual ways, kind of turning them around. And I love the little sutta where he says, he's going to teach people what it means to be a teacher and what it means to have a teacher and what it means to be a student. And he says that you're a student if you have afflictive states of mind. So the afflictive states mean the states of mind, thoughts, impulses, intentions, desires, all kinds of things that cause suffering. Then you're a student. If those afflictive states of mind assail you, I mean they attack you, then you have a teacher. So, I think maybe in some traditional sense, the teacher is kind of strict and tells you got to do this or something. And so if you're just, carrying around your ordinary collection of afflictive states, that's for you to study. That's where you study. That's how you become a student, is to look at that. But if your teacher sometimes is rather strict with you, and, comes and assails you, and it's difficult, what these mind states do. So you're so fortunate then. You have a guru. the teacher is held up in high esteem in Indian culture. So congratulations. So I like this partly because the way it turns it around, that rather than kind of looking externally for the teacher who's going to tell you something, the understanding, it really is a turning around to really come here and be with yourself, see yourself, see what's going on. Here's where the teacher is found, in you. The book of the Dharma is found in your heart, not somewhere else. And so we're here to study ourselves, to find out what's happening, and study the afflictive states, the things that are extra, things that are going to be shed, things that are going to be somehow, we're going to free ourselves from. And seven purifications. And these purifications are organized in according to the very traditional Buddhist scheme of sila, samadhi, and panya. So virtue, training in virtue, training in samadhi, training in wisdom or insight, depending how you translate panya. And the first purification is that of virtue, which I'll talk about today. The second purification is samadhi. The way they word it is they call it purification of mind. And there's something about the samadhi, the practices of concentration, the states of concentration, that are cleansing, that helps us to shed very powerfully things which are extra and are not needed as we do this homecoming and be settled on ourselves and just here in a full way. Not being scattered or caught up in the whirlwind of what's out there, or centrifugal force outwards away from ourselves, thoughts and ideas. And so the first is training in sila and samadhi are the first two purifications. The last five are all about wisdom or insight. And so we'll get to that in due time, the five. Today it's purification of virtue, or sila. And sila is the word sila is a phenomenally rich word in the Pali texts. And the more I study it, the more I kind of decided that it probably shouldn't be given an English word, but just say sila. And then you have to kind of begin again sensing over the years the context and how it's talked and to feel the richness of it. And but if I had to choose an English word, I would choose virtue. Though in most recent translations by Bhikkhu Bodhi, he translates it as virtuous behavior. So really focusing on behavior rather than the inner sense of virtue or something. And then maybe there's some wisdom that he emphasizes the behavior part, that what good is virtue if you don't act on it? So the idea that, that's also in our actions and how we live our lives. And as I was reflecting on these stages or these purifications and how it starts with virtue, I was thinking back to my very first Vipassana retreat. It was kind of an accidental retreat that I ended up in it, maybe. Not quite an accident, but it was kind of a little bit more of an accident that my first retreat was 10 weeks long. I had no plan to sit that long, but forces beyond my control, not the hard ones, but what it was that I was waiting for a visa to go back to Japan. And the Japanese embassy somehow, I was just waiting and waiting. Nothing came. So thanks to the Japanese embassy in Bangkok, my first Vipassana retreat was 10 weeks long. And that was enough to get my attention. And when I look back, thinking about these stages of purification and how it begins with virtue, I was thinking back at that first retreat. And I think one of the really significant aspects of that retreat was a purification of virtue. I had no interest in virtue and being ethical earlier in my life. It was just not in my world to kind of think that way or be concerned. If anything, I thought being ethical was being a goody-two-shoes, they say in English. Something which is not so, you're not supposed to, whatever it is, you're not supposed to be it. I lived an ethical life, so it wasn't like I was being unethical. But I think I attribute that mostly to a lack of imagination. Rather than, that I was particularly ethical. But then I was there and sitting in this retreat, and I was sitting these long, long days and sitting and sitting. And at some point, I started feeling very different on the inside in a way that I'd never felt before. And I felt clean. This physical sensation of the inside, I was really clean. My whole inside of my torso felt just clean. pure, a word that I usually don't like to use so much. It's a sense of pure. I was breathing in this cleanliness and this kind of radiated or kind of felt it here. It just felt so precious, so delicious to feel this sense of being clean. And it had a feeling to me that, as I stayed with it, to recognize that this is a kind of ethical cleansiness. It's going to feel clean ethically. And then I was a little surprised that I had, before I came to that retreat, I'd met a woman, and I had, garden variety lust for her, if you can have that. It wasn't over the top, but it still was. It wasn't just simply appreciation and love. I was a young man. So we'll call it lust. So I was sitting there in this quietly, and then in the state where I, surprising state that being feeling clean, and thoughts about this woman came up. And as the thoughts came up, I could feel, sense that there was no lust, and that any movement in that direction just felt like a closing down of that open space of cleanliness. That any movement in that direction was kind of I could feel it as a kind of violence to myself even. And somehow it felt, I could feel, I wasn't going to act on it there and then. I was on retreat, but so it wasn't a matter of what was best for her at that moment, but it was really just, I could feel it. Why would I do that? Why would I lose this wonderful sense of goodness and wholeness and purity that I had, cleanliness that I had, to pick up or get involved in this thing that was much more irritating or agitating or troubling to have. And that surprised me to experience that. And I'd never experienced something like that, and to see how that reference point. And so maybe that was the beginning for when lust became my teacher. Because then I knew something about it. I understood it in a way that I hadn't before, and understood the impact of it, and understood there was something other, something different that maybe was more important and more valuable than that. And so this experience of having shed enough of our agitations, shed enough of the mind kind of spinning and in such a way that we're not really in touch with ourselves. Sometimes we get alienated from ourselves, living in stories and expectations and regrets and plans for the future and building up ideas of self and, this world that we can have that in so many different ways we end up spinning away from ourselves and not being connected. And, I think a lot of people, I think all of you know, when they first start to meditate, they're surprised to discover that spinning, agitated, fragmented world that they've been living in. And it becomes, a movement of being to settle that down and quiet down, come home, come here. And I think that to some degree, sooner or later, there's an experiential sense of this inner world of harm and the absence of harm. What hurts? What's difficult? And we see it here on the retreats in a way that is very inspiring, and also for some people very painful, is the slightest little thing that is kind of causes harm here. It's like we have a magnifying glass on it. And it's just like people are devastated sometimes, I didn't see the person was heading for the meal line, and I stepped in front of the person. I mean, it's like, it's like major news. out in the world, you probably wouldn't even notice the person, you wouldn't notice anything, or if it happened, well, you're busy with your cell phone and, to care or something, but here it really stands out. And I think it's beautiful that we're so sensitive here. And I think it's unfortunate sometimes when that beautiful way of being sensitive gets somehow augmented by some kind of beating ourselves up and feeling bad about ourselves. I think that so you know, it's nice to actually appreciate the sensitivity, the ethical sensitivity we have. Appreciate that we care so much, and that these things have that kind of impact. And in some ways, be glad, but you know, but not glad at what you did, but glad that you have that response to it. Oh, that doesn't feel good. And so one of the primary principle for virtue, for I think all of the Dharma, that's the center, the heart of this Dharma thing, is not harming. In fact, there's a little slogan from a few hundred years after the Buddha where it says that the characteristic of the Dharma is non-harming. And the word is ahimsa, which is now a famous word around the world. And the characteristic of the Dharma is non-harming. And so so if it's Dharma, there's non-harming as part of it. If it's harming, intentional harm is part of it, then it's not the Dharma. And that's a powerful thing to say about the Dharma itself, that it isn't just simply that, you know, there's virtue and you shouldn't hurt people and harm. You know, and we'll get on to the real Dharma once we get this out of the way. It is the real Dharma. It's the heart of it. And it isn't that, you know, practicing the purification of virtue is, you know, an unfortunate thing you have to get over with and, you know, get on to the real thing. Maybe it is the heart of the Dharma. Everything else maybe is supporting that. And partly we understand that because one of the purposes of this whole path here in this week's calling of the path of purification is to purify or cleanse ourselves or empty ourselves of the ways in which we cause harm, any direction, but in particular to ourselves. And you know, there's all these, anytime we cling, anytime we have hostility to anything, then we're causing harm to ourselves. Anytime we're caught up in delusion, we're in a certain kind of way harming ourselves. Caught up in lust, caught up in anger, caught up, anything we're caught up in, that caught upness is a kind of contraction and tightness that, you know, causes, you know, is a kind of harm, is a kind of ouch. And to some, you know, degree, we have to understand in this practice how we assail ourselves, what we're doing to ourselves. And so can we kind of work through that and come to the other side? And so that Buddha said, and the Buddha said, so that you are not a student and don't have a teacher. And in that same little story, you don't have a teacher when you no longer have any afflictive states that assail you, and you're no longer a student when you have no more afflictive states of mind. So that's what we're going for. No longer being a student or having a teacher. So for lay people, the primary association for sila is the pancha sila, the five silas. Five, we say in English, five precepts. And I also, for, you know, wasn't going around killing people and stealing. But but I really didn't have much association or appreciation of these five until I began to understand that they weren't things that we added to our lives. They're really things that we take away from our lives. It's afflictive states of mind that are responsible for the motivation to do unethical things, to break this, to violate the precepts. It's not a matter of doing something new to live by the precepts. It's undoing and not doing something. It's not killing. It's not stealing. It's not engaging in sexual misconduct. It's not lying. And it's not intoxicating oneself with alcohol and other intoxicants. It's a simplifying. It's a letting go. It's a part of this shedding, part of this purification. It's living a simpler life or a more open life or certainly a freer life by not having these inner forces operating which are afflictive, which are agitating, which are I think involves some kind of actually loss of freedom. I think it's very hard for me to imagine that, or it's very easy for me to imagine that people who violate the precepts through things like killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, that there is a kind of bondage that they're in. They're kind of caught. They're not really free. Sometimes people feel free when they do these things because they just don't have anything to do, anything that limits their desires or what they want, and so they feel like they're freer if they just go ahead and do these things. But I think it's the opposite. There's no freedom in those things, though they might feel like that way. And so this purification of virtue has a lot to do in the teachings of the Buddha. The usual language in English is to abstain, to refrain. And so it's the not doing something. And so you're not being asked to do anything different or new or in some ways. You're asking to not do something. And not for the purposes of diminishing yourself, but for the purposes of enhancing yourself. Or as Brian said yesterday, he said he referred to the teaching about giving up a lesser happiness for a greater happiness. And then we could add to that, giving up an affliction for happiness. Giving up bondage for freedom. So, to be interested in these precepts or the abstaining, which to a very large degree you're doing here at this retreat. Not only are you not killing each other, but I think that you're very careful about the life that lives here at IRC and the insects and whatever you see. And I kind of suspect there's a real high care and sensitivity to all forms of life who are here. And it's beautiful. And I don't think that you're going around stealing from each other. In fact, I feel pretty confident that if I left my wallet with all its wealth under the bulletin board downstairs in that table, that it either would just stay there for a few days, or someone would bring it to the managers, and the managers would kind of figure out who it belongs to, or just keep it safe until someone came and said, I can't find my wallet. I have no doubt that it would be preserved somehow, that it would disappear. And that's what happened, actually. Some few years ago, a man dropped his wallet on that wonderful rug downstairs. Someone picked it up and put it in the hands of the Buddha statue that was there then. You know, the Buddha was meditating with the wallet on top. And this man didn't realize he had missed his wallet, that he lost it or was gone. And that wallet stayed there and stayed there and stayed there for a couple of days until he realized it was his wallet. I thought that was great. This is a wonderful field, and you're all being ethical, I would say, in a pretty high degree compared to, the newspapers. And one of the things about being ethical is that what I think one of the hopes the Buddha had, or what the Buddha pointed to, is that it can be a source of joy, of happiness. And among other things, he called it the bliss of blamelessness. And so, to take time to see if there's some way your practice can be nourished, encouraged, inspired, gladdened by the fact that for these days, you're very ethical. You might have done some unethical things the day before you came, but at least for these days, it's pretty wonderful. And there is this encouragement that even for these days, it really counts. Some people have such a strong tendency to be self-critical and find out all the things that are wrong. I used to remember going into the meditation hall at Green Gulch Zen Center, and I was completely wrong, guilty, before being accused for how I opened and closed the door to the meditation hall. I mean, that was enough to be, feel like I was just like, I blew it. Boy, I was did it all wrong. And now I probably pass that on to you and telling you the first day about being really careful about the doors. I was so easy to have this and to forget to kind of prioritize these kinds of self-critical voices we have and think that that's where, that they have so much authority and count for so much, and lose sight of the bigger picture of what's happening. And one of the larger perspectives happening here is there's a lot of goodness here and a lot of goodness in you. And the fact that you're living this way, living by the precepts, living with this goodness, offering your support to the community with the jobs you do and the silence you keep and the care that you give. It should be, the idea is that one of the possibilities, if you like, is to really delight in that and appreciate that and appreciate yourself for it and see if you can find some sense of the goodness, without the goodness of that or within you. And if you can't find it in the same way that I felt this, that first retreat, the sense of cleanliness inside, it'll come as you settle in. It's not a matter of attaining it, it's a matter of really shedding and letting go of all the forces of agitation that keep us from feeling actually the tremendous goodness that's here within us. We're a huge reservoir of goodness that exists within us. That's masked by surface, I think of it as surface thoughts, surface states, surface emotions, surface motivations. So I think of greed and anger and hostility and delusion as kind of surface phenomena. Whereas this reservoir of goodness is what's in our home inside, deep inside, the essence, what's here. So we're coming home to ourselves. So one of the ways that ways of interpreting this emphasis on sila is to be very careful with not being in conflict with yourself or in conflict with your experience. So whatever is happening, don't kind of jump on it and say, that's wrong, that's bad, I shouldn't have it, I'm wrong for having it. All these ways of being in conflict with things, and being in conflict with your physical pain, being in conflict with your mind that's thinking a lot, being in conflict with the unexpected emotions that come up, and in conflict with being tired. There's something about being in conflict. The word conflict means the Latin word, I think, means with striking, with hitting something. And so what is it to be, the Dharma means non-harming, non-conflict. What is it to be present for our pains and our angers and our thinking, busy thinking mind and our all these things, not to indulge in them, not to be carried away with them, swept away with them, but rather to, but also not to be caught in their web by feeling you're in conflict with them. If in certain situations, people can get tense. Maybe they're afraid or angry or something. And one of the things that sometimes physiologically we can do, maybe even without intending it, is we can make a fist. You know, like hold ourselves in or get tight or, you know. And then the fist, hold it tight, kind of hurts. And so then you kind of like to stop holding the hand so tight and curled up. So the only tool you have that you know about is your fist. So you tighten up more to get rid of the fist. That's, you know, that didn't quite work, but the only tool you have is to have a fist, so you tighten up more and more and more. I'm using this analogy because, like for example, one of the things that afflicts people, meditators sometimes, is a lot of thinking. And then people start thinking about how to solve the problem of thinking. And, you know, it's just, you're just kind of thinking more, you're thinking better, you know, just you're adding more fire to the fuel. And even the idea that, you know, I have a problem sometimes that I have to kind of solve, that very idea of a problem sometimes it operates a little bit like, you know, just the fist tightening up even more. So it's kind of a difficult thing to kind of find the way with what I'm about to say. But there's a way of kind of not seeing, not getting involved with things as if they're a fire, as if they're a problem. And not using fire to fight fire, not using thoughts to fight thoughts. So one of the options that works with this practice that sometimes is helpful is to keep it really simple, but is to keep using the what's called the anchor as an alternative to thinking about how to deal with your thinking, or an alternative of addressing your thinking in such a way by addressing, trying to practice with it, you're actually keeping it going. Some things are kept going by the way we bring our attention to it. Some things are settled by the way we bring attention to it. And sometimes you have to see, you know, the way I'm doing this, the way I'm bringing my attention to it, it's not really helping. And sometimes what helps is just to let it be and stay with the anchor. And the anchor for a boat, if a boat doesn't have an anchor, it drifts off. And if it can be dangerous, it drifts off and crashes against the shore and goes out to sea. If the mind doesn't have some kind of anchor, then we're susceptible to all the currents that come along, all the winds and things that waves that push us this way and that way. But if we have an anchor, then we're not so susceptible. The currents are still there, the winds, waves and winds are still there, but we're not going to be carried away by them and caught up in them. So, for example, so to have an anchor, which can be the rising and falling, feeling the experience of the body breathing, sometimes there are times where that's a way of keeping things so simple and not fueling, not feeding the things that were bothering us and troubling us. So we're caught up in the stories we tell ourselves about our lives and who did what to who and what needs to happen. And these stories are important. They certainly have their place to address and deal with. But there's a way in which sometimes staying too much involved in them just kind of, you know, is feeding, putting fuel in the fire, or tightening up the fist even more. So sometimes it's just you know, just wise to see it clearly, it's happening, not to deny it, not to repress it, but return to the anchor and let the winds blow as they do. But, you know, with the anchor, you're not going to be swept away by stuff, and eventually the winds will die out. And some of these winds and currents slow down and stop a lot faster if we're not feeding them. So this idea of coming into the, you know, something like the, you know, the rising and passing is the classic Mahasi thing to do, of the belly going in and out. But it could be other aspects of the breathing, and other things can be anchors as well. And then how you are present for your experience is actually quite important. And so, as I said, that the first night, you know, to spend some time as you're refining and little bit maybe adjusting how you stay with the anchor, how you stay with any experience and be mindful of it. Can you adjust it and kind of open to it and find a way where maybe there's no sense of conflict with what is, where there's no sense of, you know, trying to do something and get something, where there's a kind of a willingness to kind of be more open, more soft, more easeful, maybe in the awareness. It's not easy to do that. It's not easy to be easeful. But to kind of begin seeing, is there some way in the middle of my knee burning and hot, in the middle of my discouragement that I'm feeling, can I find a way to be present for it, really here for it, where I'm not pulled into stories, not pulled into self-doubt, not pulled into self-criticism, or but where I'm not pulled into aversion or something, but where I'm present in an open-handed way, not with a fist, just open here with this. And I found that when I do mental noting, that one of the benefits of mental noting that I found was the tone in which I enunciated the mental note taught me a lot about my relationship and what was going on. If I went, you know, if I'm feeling some kind of pain, I go, pain, oh, pain, pain, you know, I was caught. But if I said, oh, pain, pain, then, you know, I could feel that difference. And some people find that if they have the attitude, they can feel, you know, not just pain, but my pain versus the pain. That also makes a difference. It's easier when it's just the pain. The my thing is complicated. And then if I'm feeling some wonderful warmth and little pleasure somewhere, and my big toe is tingling happily, something, and then I say, you know, so then mental note goes, oh, pleasure, oh. And I hear it, and then I know I'm caught again, I'm involved. So where it might seem wise to just say pain simply, rather than just grit your teeth and say it, it might not seem as wise to say just pleasure when it's pleasure. Why not just enjoy it? Because you want to be free. We're going home. Don't let the sirens of Odyssey pull you off into this and that. There's all these sirens that are singing their song. Come here, come here. Ulysses is going home, right? You're going home. This is a journey home that we're doing here. And it's a profound thing to come home. So this first chariot is the purification of virtue, purification of our goodness, the revealing of our goodness, the revealing of our virtue. And you can support it and help it by living by the precepts, being sensitive and caring for your ethics, and not just for what you do externally, but also how you think. And of course, we think all kinds of ways, but to begin appreciating or gravitating towards or nourishing or that place inside of you that is not going to be involved with lust and hatred and delusion and lying and stealing and whatever it might be. And that place, you know, begin kind of appreciating that and opening to it and being glad for the degree to which you are ethical. And it's probably, you probably become more ethical faster if you appreciate the degree to which you are ethical than if you are upset by the degree to which you're unethical. We don't want you to keep indulging the unethical, but do appreciate it. It opens, let that door open, let that space, that recognition help you to feel better about coming home, feel better about being with your breathing, feel better just being here in this body. And that's so much of, you know, what we're trying to do here is to find a way, a loving way, a caring way, inspiring way, to really be here, present for this life, this breathing, this heart, this here, from the inside out, so that we really feel like we've arrived home. And then to really know that deep inner home that can only happen, only feel here, the place where we're with ourselves and present and mindful, breathing. To really know that and be willing to experiment, take the risk to come home, to really do that work, to put aside anything which is not about home here. And then, one day, someday, in distant future, you'll leave IRC, and maybe you'll bring that home with you. And you'll take it with you everywhere you go. And you'll not have lost the world by going inward this way. You gain the world in the process. Thank you.